David Woodard talk. I had a professor named David Montgomery. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
Welcome to the historic McFarland Hubbard House. I see some new faces here. We're pleased to have you with us. This is the headquarters of the West Virginia Humanities Council. This is the first little lecture for 2017. It's the 65th lecture in our series. We've been doing these lectures continuously every year since 2001. We think it's the longest running lecture series in the state. This year, we are looking forward to another fine lineup of interesting talks on a variety of subjects. We have three more after today. April 30, Why Shakespeare Matters by Concord University Professor Gabriel Rieger. May 21, The Story of Henderson Hall Plantation by Henderson Hall Director Randy Modisett. And June 25, West Virginia Musicians and the Nashville Sound by WVU Professor Travis Steinling. Today's speaker is Marshall University Professor Emeritus David R. Woodard, who will speak about the American Army and World War I. Professor Woodard's lecture is timely since April 4th will mark the 100th anniversary of the U.S. entry in what was then called the Great War. It was also called the War to End Wars. Professor Woodard is a Tennessee boy originally with an MA and PhD from the University of Georgia. He taught history at Texas A&M and for more than three decades at Marshall University. He taught 15 different courses with a focus on military history, Russian history, and European history. He's written numerous articles for the Journal of Modern History, the Historical Journal, and other publications. He's authored eight books on subjects, including British Prime Minister David Lloyd George's role in the Great War, U.S. relations with Great Britain in 1917-1918, and the British campaign in Palestine. His book, Hell in the Holy Land, World War I in the Middle East, published in Britain as Forgotten Soldiers of the First World War, was adopted by both the History Book Club and the Military History Book Club. Professor Woodard served as a consultant for the BBC on a program about David Lloyd George and contributed an article on the Middle East during World War I to the BBC History website. Since his retirement in 2006, he's continued to write. The following books, Since That Time, America and World War I, a selected annotated bibliography, published by Routledge in 2007, and his World War I Almanac by Facts on File in 2009. His most recent book is The American Army and the First World War, published by Cambridge University Press in 2014. It's dedicated to Frank Buckles, the last American World War I veteran who died in 2011 at age 110 at his farm in West Virginia. We invite you to join us for wine and refreshments in the sunroom following the program. And now please welcome today's speaker, Professor David Woodard.
Thank you, Ken. Well, the United States was certainly not a military power when the First World War broke out. Today, of course, it very much is. What we spend on the military several years ago was 10 times, the next 10 countries in the world. Add that up and you'd have gotten what the United spent. Now it's gone down, you have to add up the next 7 countries in the world to do it today. That was a very, very different story when the United States mobilized in 1917 for war. When the war itself had started, the United States had an army that you could hardly find. Before the Spanish-American War, it had an authorized strength of a little less than 30,000. In 1914, it had 3,820 officers and 84,799 men. So it also had not the equipment of a modern army. It basically was an army of a rifle and a bayonet. We do produce, during the course of the war, a fantastic machine gun, the Browning machine gun, and also the Browning automatic rifle. But we don't have those weapons in the hands of our soldiers until the last few weeks of the war. So we were essentially a 19th century army when the war started, and they did not change very much during the early years of the war. That's not to say that we had not made some very important reforms before 1914. We had embraced the general staff version of war. When you've got a group of experts serving as the brain of the army, this had been done as opposed to having a Napoleon Bonaparte, a great captain of war. You waged war in part by a committee of good officers. We also had a war college, we had a staff college, we had changed the way we raised our armies. For the longest time, we had state militias, which were really focused on the states. We now, however, had a National Guard equipped by the government and tied to the standing army as a reserve. When the war started, our president is Woodrow Wilson, a most unmilitary man. He learned that our general staff, very small group of officers in Washington, D.C., were making studies of the war in Europe. He was infuriated. He even thought of sending the general staff out of Washington because they were war gaming. Now, it was explained to him that, well, they're not planning to go to war, but they need to have some plans to have if that event ever occurs. And so he did accept that. Now, our weakness as a military power was further demonstrated when Pancho Villa decided to pay an American town a visit, killing some Americans. Well, it was hell to raise a force just to chase him around Mexico for a while. And the man chosen to do that was John J. Pershing, who turns out to be the leader of the American Expeditionary Force that we send to Europe in 1917. Well, Pershing never found Villa, chased him around, and eventually we withdrew our forces. But in some respects, it showed our weakness. Meanwhile, the Germans, who had also analyzed American strength during this period, had decided that pretty much with impunity, they could arrange a blockade around the British Isles, and they could sink any American ship, except they were going to allow one ship a week to go and one ship a week to leave Great Britain. So they began sinking our ships. And that was going to force Wilson into a war he really didn't want to fight. But he really now had no choice. We go to war. The American people, when we went to war after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, showed up to enlist and fight. We don't have the same kind of response when we declare war on Germany. During the first 10 days, 4,355 men showed up to volunteer to fight. Now that improves. In the next 3 weeks, some 32,000 had been signed. Well, we were never going to have an army of any real size if we didn't do something differently and not depend on volunteers. So Wilson made a very critical decision. He decided to embrace selective service. He did this in part because one of his political opponents, Teddy Roosevelt, was running around the country saying that he wanted to raise a volunteer army and lead it to fight in Europe. And Wilson knew that if Roosevelt got to do that, he would pretty much take control of the war. So Wilson decided to accept selective service. In the end, some 23,234,000 young Americans registered for the draft. And we eventually draft some 3 million men. That included, by the way, almost 400,000 African Americans, which was a very interesting feature. But how do you make soldiers out of all of these young men, healthy, young for the most part? We don't have a way to do it at first. We had to build 32 training camps. 16 in the north, they were wooden buildings. 16 in the south, they were tents. But this was an amazing project, just to find a place to train all of these men. We also don't have the experienced officers to equip them mentally to fight a industrialized war. Our key weapons were the bayonet and the rifle. And that was pretty much it. So we did get some help from the French and the British. They send some 800 experienced soldiers over to help train us. Wilson also made the decision to appoint Pershing as the commander-in-chief. He clearly was the best choice, even though his ideas on doctrine were very much dated and not realistic, in part because he had such great faith in the American soldier. He felt they were, well, obviously, they were American. He, of course, was German heritage, but they were, and many other Germans. You had something like 400,000 Germans who end up fighting in the American army. But his principle was courage on the battlefield, close with the enemy. And so, as far as he was concerned, the war-winning weapon for the United States was the rifle and the bayonet. This would have worked pretty well if Napoleon had been around and had been the early part of the 19th century. But amazing advances had been made in the killing power of weapons. You had tanks, you had airplanes, you had flamethrowers, you had poison gas, and the only real purpose of charging, of teaching soldiers to use a bayonet was to try to encourage them not to take the ground when they were attacking, but to engage with the enemy. And that made a certain amount of sense. I think a few years ago, they actually stopped bayonet training in the Marines, but they brought it back. I think I'm right in that. But you know, the principle of a bayonet and a rifle and engaging the enemy was just part of military training. But it should not have been the essential part of fighting. Some of these Germans, by the way, and some other foreigners who ended up being drafted, couldn't speak English, or not very well. And so in the training camps, you actually had language schools to teach them English before they were sent abroad. There's this story that I find very interesting. When we had won the war, we were occupying the Rhineland, and some soldiers were marching into a town for the first time, and the commanding officer suddenly noticed this very excited German couple, almost jumping up and down, and they seemed to be directing their attention towards this young man. And so the officer said, "Well, what's happening?" He said, "Well, sir, they're my parents." And so you had these kind of connections. So even with the help of foreign advisors, and American officers don't like these foreigners so much anyway because they weren't American, and you know, certainly we know things better than they do despite their experience. But in one respect, the American soldier was sort of the Cadillac soldier in the First World War. He got paid the magnificent amount of $33 a month if he served overseas. Now that doesn't sound like a whole lot of money today, but compare that to what some other soldiers made. A French soldier got the magnificent sum of $1.70 a month. These are, of course, in the terms of what a dollar was worth back then. It was worth a whole lot more than it is today. The Germans, well, they got $3.21 a month. They also got, and there's real controversy about this at first, but said, we ought to have insurance for our soldiers when we send them abroad. Now, that's kind of, you're sending over some with a gun and a bayonet and you're going up against the German army, and who in the world is going to sell him insurance? Well, the answer was to that was no one. So the government took over the program. And so you could buy insurance, and many did, from the government. wasn't too bad, the payoff. $15 a month for a wife, $10 for the first child, $7.50 for the second child, $5 for each additional child. And again, lots of Americans bought, sort of made the insurance industry in some respects in the post-war world. The Army also tried to create a healthy environment for these young men who were going overseas. For example, there was a very serious effort to clear all red light districts away from the Army. They were given training. They were, Pershing would ask every officer when he would visit a particular division in France, do we have venereal disease? Do we cut it down? And so on and so forth. And in the end, only about 4% of those who served were affected. And it had been rampant in the pre-World War I Army. Another question that had to be settled was, now, where are we going to send these young men we're training? And it was not particularly good training, as I've already mentioned. When they get to France, they have to learn to fight all over again. And unfortunately, when it looked like the French and the British were going to lose, we opened the floodgates. And we started shipping young men overseas, filling up divisions, completing divisions, with some who had never fired a shot. And so that was a really unfortunate situation for a lot of these young men, to go against the German army, having never even fired a shot. Now, they're obviously a very large minority, but nonetheless, that happened. But before sending soldiers overseas, and some congressmen were surprised by this, we'd gone to war with Germany, that didn't mean we had to send an army over to fight. We could maybe use our navy, and we could do this, and so on, but you know, it hadn't been decided we actually were going to send an army. But Wilson decides that he was going to do that. And so, but where? So the general staff and some other officers, they looked at various theaters. One crazy idea was to move into Holland and attack Germany from Holland. Holland happened to be a neutral country. And how you would get an army into Holland, I'm not really sure. A more popular theater was the Balkans. What the Americans really wanted, some of these soldiers, they wanted sort of independent area where they could shine. You know, they could play the leading role rather than just being blended in with other forces. Well, in the end, all of these ideas were rejected for obvious reasons. On the other hand, even though we do most of our fighting in France, a little bit in Italy, you may not know we also sent soldiers into Russia. We end up with 5,000 soldiers in North Russia. Terrible experience for most of them. Some were from Wisconsin, and the idea was that, you know, they were from Wisconsin, they can handle fighting near the Arctic Circle. And so they arrived in England, they suddenly were given a different destination, and they were sent to North Russia, and unfortunately this terrible flu epidemic was affecting the world during this period. So some died on the way over, others died after they got there. But they suffered very heavy casualties, not just because they're in the Arctic Circle. This was happening in the United, more died in the United States from the flu than abroad. But it was, in fact, more died from disease and accidents than in combat in the American Army. 50,000 deaths in combat, 60,000 deaths from other reasons. But these young Americans, they were persuaded, or the government was persuaded, because there were lots of war material that had been shipped into North Russia. The train system had broken down in Russia. They couldn't get these supplies away from the ports. The communists had seized power. And so the idea was, we've got to protect these supplies. The British had some other ideas, but they persuaded us to send 5,000 soldiers there. And as soon as some of these soldiers arrived, they were put on trains, then put on boats, and shipped about 200 miles in the interior and end up fighting the Red Army. We also send, as part of a coalition effort, and in part to watch the Japanese, we end up sending 10,000 soldiers to Siberia. Now, conditions, believe it or not, were better in Siberia than along the Arctic Circle, and they don't really go very far into the interior. The really sad feature of these young men sent to fight in Russia was that when the war is over, they can't come home for the longest time. Those in Siberia don't get back until 1920. Those in the Arctic Circle got back about mid-1919. And they're largely forgotten about, as a matter of fact. But as opposed to getting soldiers to out-of-the-way places, getting them to Europe was the big question. You would think the United States would have a great merchant marine. But going back to the Civil War, the merchant marine had been crippled very badly. And then it was so expensive to build ships in America, they'd be being built elsewhere. We have a tiny merchant marine. We had no way to ship our soldiers to Europe. So we negotiated with the British. British, of course, wanted to get as many Americans to Europe as possible. But we still had to pay the passage. They wanted at first something like $150 or $60 to just ship them to the Atlantic, to the battlefields. But we negotiate down to around $80 a soldier. And half of the Americans shipped to Europe were shipped in British ships. We also were lucky in some respects because when the war started, there were a lot of German ships that couldn't get back home. One was the largest passenger ship in the world. It was called the Fatherland initially. We rename it. But we actually were able to ship 140,000 men in this great passenger ship. Now, they were sleeping two, three to a bed, taking shifts. They could hardly, it was sort of elbow to elbow. But we shipped something like 160,000 soldiers to Europe on this one ship.
Wow.
It also was a very fast ship. And there was this concern about German U-boats. But, and it's amazing, really, only one of these ships carrying American soldiers was actually sunk. Part of that was the adoption of the convoy system. But again, that's an incredible record that only one of these ships bearing American soldiers was torpedoed and sunk. The others arrived safely. There was, once these American soldiers got to Europe, a real competition between the British and the French about where these soldiers should be used. The British, of course, would have loved to replace some of their soldiers because they were having trouble in the Middle East. They would have shipped them off to Palestine or Egypt to protect the British Empire, among other things, against the Turks and Germans. The French, however, also, and they had suffered greater losses in the war, they had the point, a good point, that the American Navy was working with the British Navy. So the first soldiers coming to Europe should be stationed with the French. And the British accepted that. And so the first soldiers arriving were going to be stationed with the French. Now, we can't have an independent army. We don't have the means to have an independent army. And so these American soldiers served not in French divisions, as the French wanted, as independent divisions, but serving within the boundaries of the French army. Try as we did, the best we could do by March of 1918 was to have four divisions in Europe. Now these were very large divisions because the decision was made that in a typical French or British division, many of them reduced in strength, were probably anywhere between 13 and 16 or 17,000. We decided upon monster divisions of 28,000 men. The idea was that you introduced a division this size to battle, it could last a lot longer. Well, I think that was flawed reasoning. You could be just as demoralized in a small group as a large group. There were more people that had to die before you withdrew the division, but I don't think it affected at all the fighting efficiency or improved the fighting efficiency. But nonetheless, we decided to have these really large, clumsy divisions in many respects. A lot of these soldiers, by the way, initially were involved in tough labor, building railway lines, this sort of thing. Because we wanted an independent army, we determined to eventually have an independent army, and we had to have logistics to support that. So railway lines had to be built, warehouses had to be constructed, and so on and so forth. Now, a lot of this heavy lifting was being done by African Americans because, you know, there wasn't the idea that you didn't have integrated units. What you had eventually were a couple of African American divisions with white officers. But most of these African Americans were doing railway work, building warehouses, unloading ships. Pershing got the bright idea that, well, as he told one African American when he was visiting these docks, you know, if you continue to work hard like this, we're going to put you into combat. You're going to be up in the front lines as a reward. Now, curiously, this soldier didn't seem impressed by that. He said, no, he was doing just fine where he was. And so Pershing had a different reward system that he had competition between these gangs unloading the ships. And the ones that performed best would be the first to go home. And that did get people's attention. And all in all, the African Americans play a very key role in logistics. But time was running out. And for the Germans, too. But the Germans had one advantage. They had just defeated Russia. They were able to transfer as many as 1 million soldiers from the Eastern Front to the Western Front. And this, and they have a very aggressive commander, the real commander, Ludendorff, and he felt he had to end the war now before the Americans could really start playing a role. The British don't anticipate an all-out German offensive, and they weren't really fully prepared for it when it came. But that was Ludendorff's gamble, that he could defeat the British and the French before the Americans could play an effective role. And so on March the 21st, he launched a surprise attack that enjoyed success. Now, what success was often measured in yards on the Western Front. But this was a fairly distant advance. He advanced, instead of yards, he advanced miles. It looked like for a while the British Army might collapse. It doesn't. The French don't either. And so his first attack was successful by the terms of what usually happened when one side attacked the other. But it didn't come close to ending the war. He tries four more times. Each month, the Germans attack as desperation begins to grow stronger and stronger in the leadership of the German army. During that period, more and more Americans are coming across. They do not have, however, any sort of modern equipment besides the rifle and the bayonet to fight the war. And amazing for me, even today, because unlike the Second World War, where the United States was this powerhouse in producing war material, we don't just equip our army, we equip the British, the Russians, I mean, an enormous amount of material. We literally bury the Germans with airplanes and tanks and other weapons of war. Finally, the atomic bomb, as far as the Japanese were concerned. But our industry failed all across the line. We produce airplanes with a gas tank right next to the pilot that we don't even use. We end up using French airplanes. We produce tanks that could be easily penetrated, and so we don't fight with American tanks, American airplanes. We don't have the factories for the heavy artillery. We could produce naval guns, which we've been doing before the war, but we don't get our artillery to Europe. We don't have our flamethrowers. We do produce poison gas, but that, I suppose, was easier to produce and get to Europe. But if we had to fight on our own means, it would have been a rifle and a bayonet. So we are equipped by our allies. And it's for that reason become a much more effective fighting army. But we have to start entering the battle as the Germans are making progress with one big attack after another. On May the 28th, we make our first serious attack by a single regiment. at Cantigny. The British and the French really want us to succeed. They deployed lots of artillery, air power, and so on and so forth. And so we attacked Cantigny after this monstrous bombardment and support from the air. We achieved success. We take this village. But then the fighting starts getting tougher and tougher and tougher. But all in all, Cantigny was a success. It almost had to be from our perspective and our allies' perspective. But a quarter of the attacking force was either killed or wounded after a few days fighting. This was not at all unusual in the kind of warfare that was being waged in Europe. You know, the casualty rate was just enormous. But still, it was pretty shocking for some. But it was a success. It had to be a success. Meanwhile, the Germans are launching the third offensive of the year. This time they're attacking the French instead of the British. And they do something that really hadn't been done since the early days of the war. They sort of end the stalemate and create momentarily a war of movement. They break clean through the French front. They advance into open country, no trenches in front of them. Of course, they start outrunning their supplies, and there are all kinds of problems when you're having a distant advance with a large army. But it really seemed very, very serious. And it forces us to give as much help as we possibly could. And as the Germans close in on Paris, we start committing what troops we have, those that had some training, to the battle. And the Germans were getting to the Marne, Paris was not too far away, and we start putting more and more soldiers into the line. One group of soldiers, Marines, not many Marines fight in the war, they actually fought with an army division, they were half of an army division, but they end up fighting at Belleau Wood, which is part of the Marine legacy. Initially they attack, and the Germans haven't prepared elaborate defenses or anything else, they're just marching through, and they'd gotten to this point in the line. There were no trenches dug or anything else at first, and so we attack with rifle and bayonet and not much artillery preparation. And we lose heavily at first. We then decide to advance into Belleau Wood and take that patch of real estate. It becomes one of the hardest fights the Marines have ever had. It also got a great deal of publicity back in America, with Marines being given a lot of attention, to the chagrin of many in the Army. But nonetheless, it was vicious fighting, back and forth, back and forth. But we eventually take Belleau Wood, and it's part of the Marine legacy. You ask a Marine about Belleau Wood, he'll probably know something about it. Elsewhere, U.S. divisions were playing an important role now in counteroffenses, and they were having success. But we're not fighting yet as an independent American army. But we have by now 9 divisions involved. And this German attack was stalled. The last German attack, the fifth in 5 months, was also stalled. Meanwhile, the French High Command, which was having a real role, we were still fighting as part of the French Army, had prepared for a counteroffensive. And we launch this, we launch it successfully. The Germans are pushed back. And Pershing, having committed 9 divisions to this battle, now insisted and got his demand accepted that the Americans actually form an independent army, which was done. On August the 10th, we now have the First Army. We also have now our own theater. Pershing wanted to attack near St. Mihiel. Ultimately, his attack was the German border and across, and this is where the Americans had decided to win the war. They made these plans as they were, Pershing and his staff were going to Europe for the first time. But St. Mihiel was the first of those operations. Fortunately, we attack as the Germans are withdrawing. They were defending a salient, and so they had pulled back a lot of their artillery already, and they were beginning to withdraw, straighten their line, make their defenses stronger. And so we attack as the Germans are pulling back. Couldn't have better timing. And we have a real success. We cover ground, we cover it fairly quickly. Pershing was wanting to keep going, but Foch, who's the commander of all of the Allied forces, had other plans. He wanted to shift the Americans. It's now an independent army. We wanted to shift the Americans and have these converging attacks on the Germans. Pershing wanted to keep going straight ahead. He almost got into a fist fight with Foch over this, but he controlled his temper. And what he didn't like in particular was the American forces were going to be divided. And he'd just finally gotten his own army. And now they want to cut it up and send divisions here and divisions there. So he was prepared to do almost anything to prevent that from happening. What he agreed to, however, was bad luck for the men he commanded. He agreed to attack not too far from Verdun, but between the Meuse River and the Argonne Forest. This is going to be the great American battle of the war. The Germans had been defending this territory for years. They had incredibly strong defenses. It was a rugged area, wooded. There were the heights on one side where the Germans could put their artillery. It was about a 20-mile front. And there were a lot of disadvantages, but the real advantage to Pershing was he had his own army, and he was going to whip the Germans and end the war. So the great feat, really, of this attack was that many American divisions were moved without the Germans knowing about it. And so after this horrendous artillery bombardment, first day, more munitions were expended in this one day than the Union forces and the Confederate forces expended during the entire Civil War. Just to give you an example of what was being brought to bear against the Germans. Sadly, the Germans, anticipating this attack, had withdrawn most of their soldiers from their forward trenches and had replaced them with machine guns. So a lot of this fireworks display or artillery bombardment didn't really kill a lot of Germans or paralyze them. And when the Americans advance, they find it really tough going. Pershing had these ambitious objectives for the first two or three days. Those objectives aren't reached for many weeks. But we were stalled pretty early on. And Foch and some others tried to get rid of Pershing at this point. They wanted to be replaced. That didn't work, however. But we were bogged down. We really weren't going anywhere. We were using lots of inexperienced American soldiers. Again, some had never fired a rifle before they were sent into combat. And so not surprisingly, lots of stragglers began to appear on the battlefield. It's been estimated by some historians that 1 out of 10 Americans on the front lines during this period were stragglers. You know, they were separated from the command, they'd found a good place to hide, or whatever. But that they had abandoned their units. They were rounded up, of course. Pershing wanted to shoot a bunch of them, but Wilson had already told him, we're not going to execute American soldiers, unless it's for some horrible crime or something. But for disobedience or discipline or whatever, you can't do it. Pershing issued separate orders saying, well, if you're on the field, a man is not what he's supposed to be doing, and you're an officer, you can go ahead and shoot him. But there weren't going to be trials or anything. And I'm not sure that ever happened very often. But Pershing had actually given officers the permission to do that. But I'm sure there are a lot of officers who simply wouldn't do that, pull the trigger on an American soldier who was 21 years old. He was going into combat for the first time. He didn't have particularly good leadership to begin with at the unit level. And I mean, I just think a lot of officers wouldn't have done it anyway. But some maybe did. We don't really break out from at Meuse-Argonne until November the 1st. And a hint, the war's going to be over in 10 more days. But we actually break through the German defenses and began a fairly rapid advance. Meanwhile, the Germans are trying to negotiate an armistice. And the agreement had been made. It was to go into effect on November the 11th at 12 o'clock. What would you have done as an officer with your men if you knew there was going to be an armistice in the next few hours? Would you have attacked up to that final moment? Many divisions continue to attack until noon. The last American to be killed died. His name was Nicholson Gunter. He was a second generation German. He had recently been broken from a sergeant to a private, and maybe not because he was a coward or anything, but he had done something against Army regulations, and he'd just been busted. And who knows what was in his mind? But he's rushing this German machine gun nest. The Germans are trying to wave him off. Bayonet fixed, he kept coming, and he's killed with a minute to go in the war. Well, Pershing's disappointed because he still hadn't been able to execute his plan to invade Germany and win the war by himself. But and he wanted the war to continue. He didn't like, because the Americans were finally on the move. Even though, truth to tell, we were also on the verge of collapse because we had rushed over so many troops to Europe. We don't have the logistics to handle all of them. In many ways, it's fortunate the war ended when it did, because chaos was going to reign. Because we had done so many things so quickly just to save our allies. And we were sort of at the breaking point when the war actually ends. So I think we were very fortunate in that respect. If you want to find the largest American cemetery in Europe, you need to go to Meuse-Argonne. Everybody knows in Normandy. And the Americans do this magnificent job of maintaining their overseas cemeteries. Have any of you all ever seen the Normandy Cemetery? It's spectacular, really. I mean, it's not a blade of grass that's too tall or whatever. And the same is true at Meuse-Argonne. Martha and I were there a couple of years ago, and we may have been the only people there except for about 15 or 16 people manicuring and maintaining the cemetery. But it is a bit out of the way. And it's also a cemetery that Americans don't know anything about, if they know anything about the Meuse-Argonne offensive either, because we just don't study the First World War like we do the Second World War. But again, it's very impressive. It's an absolutely magnificent cemetery. And it's a great memorial, I think, to those who fought and died in a perfectly horrific war. Now, once the fighting's over, the squabbling begins between politicians and historians, in part about what role did the United States play in this war. Now, it was, in some respects, to the advantage of the and the British to denigrate what we had done, because we could claim a bigger role at the peace settlement if our role in defeating Germany was given proper attention. And this continues today. You'll read books by British historians who hardly mention the American effort. One man, however, actually gives America credit for ending the war when it ended. And that man should know. Ludendorff, the commander-in-chief of the German army. But he gives the Americans credit. And I think I'll just end on that point. Thank you very much.